We're a father-daughter here discussing some things that worked within our family, and we want to find out what's working in other people's family in regard to communication. True communication, like the charity it requires, begins at home. We have listed some biblical references. If you want to look some of those up on your own, we're going to read one of them right now, which is James 3, verses 1 through 10. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be.
My brothers and sisters.
Yes, I better put both of them.
I've been trying to read the Bible a little more with a non-sexist view, and so when I look at the scriptures now, I usually try and read them in that way. Karen, do you want to add any on that before I comment on that one?
Go ahead, you comment.
I could comment. The reason we chose a few pieces of scripture like this, I don't know what's happened to you on occasion, but I find over so many years of experience as a parent and grandparent and teacher and administrator, I think the things that I think back on are the unkind, unwise things I might have said to students or to my children or to my mother, my dad or son or what have you. And it's funny how that tongue in terms of communication can get you in so much difficulty. And so I thought that Karen and I review this, we thought that might be a good reference to start on in terms at least of communication as we talk in the family. We took some other references and we just put them on the board, and you may want to look at them sometime, but in 1 Peter 3rd chapter 8 to 12 in verse 10 he says, keep the tongue from speaking evil and lips from speaking guile. It comes out of Psalm 34, so just another reference that we might use. And we kind of like to start on a scriptural basis. Proverbs 4, 1 to 9 says something, the whole chapter regards getting wisdom, and I think what we are trying to seek as we develop this topic is some collective wisdom about how we communicate, particularly today. I think we'll talk more within the framework of family communication, maybe deal with some of the very difficult areas that we come to as have come to as parents raising children and for parents now. Ephesians 2, I think, is good out of 4, the 4th chapter, 29th verse, let no evil talk come out of your mouth, but only such as is good for edifying, as fits the occasion, that it may be impart grace to those who hear it. And I think a few times I remember saying, you know, if you can't say something good, don't say it. And sometimes we have a difficult time with that. Yet again, we do need to admonish with words at times. And then I think one of my favorite phrases or verses in the Bible is John 1:14, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. And we have beheld his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. And to me, in all things that we need to reflect that word and that communication as we deal with our families. Karen, next we want to deal something with what is family, or how you regard family as we look at it. We've talked about the rainbow this week. We've talked about God's family a lot. We might like some impressions on that. Maybe you want to take that wheel, Karen.
Okay. I got this wheel, and we did add one more in that, but out of Parenting for Peace and Justice by Kathleen and James McGinnis. Found a wheel first here, and it starts with the family in the very center. And it goes, and we added in the church because we think that has been an important part. It's been an important part in my life, and it was communicated to us as we were growing up, and school and job, then moving out towards community, nation, and world. When you talk about communication, if you do not know how to communicate within the family, how do you expect to communicate any place else in the world? Or, you know, moving out to the world. So we're basing it that the communication and lines of communication need to be open right within the family. And but to start that out, who is family? We've come up with some definitions on who is family.
We could have put another circle for church and the workplace too, to some degree. Because this particular graph didn't carry it, we put it in that framework. But we kind of wonder, how do you look at family? I mean, do you have any kind of feelings about family as such? Most of the we think of our nuclear family, you know, mother, father, children.
I think of it in terms of a clan.
You extended. Your grandchild.
Yes, and also my brothers and sisters and their families, and Rudy's brothers and sisters and their families. Because we get together periodically. We live a long way apart, but every 3 years we get together. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to feel that they are our family.
Tonight, Maren Hinderle is going to deal with family stories. We had put that as one of our sessions too, to talk about the extended family and what happens in that. So tonight, Maren is going to, we're going to help Maren tonight talk some about family stories, or developing family history. And that's what you talk about, the clan. That's a little bit of what we're thinking about too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And ours are kind of close. Go ahead.
Our family's kind of gotten extended to neighbors, actually, and our children have, I don't know if you want to call it adopted grandparents, but the neighbor lady that lived next door that was our property, so became Grandma Winnin to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was growing up, I had no grandparents of my own, and our family seemed to get older people that became my grandparents that I never experienced. So family to me can be extended.
We think that, yeah, that's really a marvelous idea and a wonderful thought, where a lot of people, as they grow older, you can just see the light in their eyes when they see children or family like that.
I know. Our family, we've grown up, and my children have both sets of grandparents in the same community. And like our family's almost like a different word for clan. It's like a community, could be a community within itself. And everything is kind of provided, and the cousins love to get together, and there is that sense of community, a sense of love. If my children cannot talk to me about a problem, they know they have an aunt. They have a couple different aunts they can talk to. They have grandparents they can talk to. There's been times in the morning getting ready to go to school, and my children have we've come to dead ends as far as communicating. And the first thing they pick up the phone and call Grandpa and Grandma, and to see if they can get sympathy on that side. And
they play them against you or something.
They do a very good job of trying. And, but they, you know, we still, you know, we've, we're pretty consistent with, I was brought up by my parents, and so they listen. And I think that's one of the most important thing to do, that they listen.
And we can talk, we'll talk about that a little bit too, because one of the areas that we feel is terribly important as you're dealing with children, which you know very well, is the importance of consistency between mother and dad, where to that extent. And also that grandparents understand that they are not in that realm of child rearing, but that you support to the extent that you can in dealing with your grandchildren. I suppose the only thing that would be different would be like you and Rudy have your grandson in your home. When he's away from his parents, then you are really in charge.
That's right.
And you have to set the standards in your home. We've kind of had that agreement too. And within our home, then if our standards are slightly different, they will still deal with this, kind of the way we live, so that they understand that. But I think that is terribly important, that that when they call and say, give us their story, you know, that we support.
So the question, within your family that's in your home, how are channels of communication kept open in the family? Or those of you that have raised your families, how did you keep your lines of communication open?
Telephone.
That's one, right.
We talk to all of our children on the weekends when the rates are cheap, yeah. And we don't have to worry about how long we're talking, so we don't have to cut things short.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about within the framework of the nuclear family?
Well, I communicate with mine now. Because there's so many of them, we can't even use the long distance on weekends. But by letter writing, and all of them call mom and dad often. And then I write a round robin letter that goes to all of them, the same letter.
Round robin letters are wonderful.
About all the stuff that they've all told me. And the children say that that's the one of the things that helps them keep in contact with all their brothers and sisters, what's going on with them.
That becomes,
because not everybody writes everybody.
It's like that's become stories too, as part of Marma said. It becomes
file.
A history too.
File our right. when the round robin comes back, we take our letter out and put it in a file, mm-hmm. because it has told our brothers and sisters what we've been doing and the things that are important to us.
Yeah, I feel kind of funny about that myself. I have files, you know, of Karen's letters and my daughter's letters and son's letters and my mother's letters. Going back a long time, and I sometimes, you know, keep filing, but it's so much fun. You know. Yes, you know, how much should you keep? But I remember when they've gone on trips, you know, or been away from home, those have become meaningful, you know. Becomes a bond, a fellowship.
I guess a question, how do you view your role as a parent in communicating? Are you a parent, as a friend, buddy? You know, what if we're talking about communication with our children as they're growing up? I have my children are 10, 8, and 6 years old. And I guess I may be looking for a little bit of advice. How did you keep those lines of communication as your children were growing up? Or parents here, how are you keeping those lines of communication open? How are you?
Maybe I can add to Karen's comment on that, because when we were talking about the reason we developed this kind of format as father and daughter, thinking back when Karen, particularly at the teenage levels, coming into the teen levels, that was, I think, one of the more difficult times. And I think that's very difficult today, but the kinds of topics that you have to talk about also have changed substantially in the last 20 years. I can remember dealing with Karen and Kathy, I'm saying about age 11 or 12, when we start talking about the relationships, particularly with boys, dating, sexual relationships, the whole range of what you were trying to trying to instruct, trying to lead and say, these are the kinds of areas. And as a high school vice principal and principal, I had a lot of experience with 1,500, 2,000 students to talk about the kinds of difficulties people get in. But in a sense, in 1963 to 65, they were a good deal less complicated than they are today. I think I would have had, I don't think I'd had any more difficult time, because I think we had a loving relationship and the channels were open. But I think it'd be very difficult to discuss the problems of sexuality, the problems of drugs, the problems of alcohol. They were coming in, and they've existed, but they were coming in with greater frequency, and it reached somewhat the climax in the late 70s. You can remember the great problems on college campuses in the mid-60s. That started to hit the high school campuses then in the late 60s and early 70s. And then, full-blown then, as we moved into the 80s, and now we're dealing with a problem that now moves down into the elementary, junior, middle and elementary school level. Well, that's now Karen's children are 6, 8, and 10. Now what I had to deal with at, I think, 11, 13, and 15, she's dealing 15. With this age. I don't know if you, and that, that's what I might share that.
Yeah, what I'm doing within my own, with my own children now is that I'm having to clarify misinformation they're coming home from school with. And so, and it's, I, and it kind of bothers me that they're not given a chance to just remain children. And they're having to grow up so fast. And I guess, how do I, you know, I want to keep that, I do want to discuss and the issues with them, but I still want them to be able to remain children.
I don't know, maybe you have some kind of feelings about that in your experience. We have some people here that have a lot of experience, I think, raising children. It'd be interesting to hear that.
I have three children. They're all very different, and they're all young adults now. But one of the things that I have seen in the different families within my own relationship is that if the parent doesn't see the child as a human being, but just someone who happens to be there and needs to listen to them, give directions, then that child doesn't grow up with a feeling of much self-worth. And the difference to me is that the child has something worthwhile to say and the parent needs to listen, and that's how the lines of communication are kept open. That person, no matter what he says, it's worth, you know, listening to.
I think that's where grandparents come in handy.
Grandparents are good at that.
Because I know we're always affirming our grandchildren. And a lot of times, I think the parents do too, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grandparents do have a great opportunity to be very affirming.
Well, it's a lot harder for me to say no now than I ever used to.
Yes, correct. That's a good point.
I get treatises if I say no. Mm-hmm. My daughter presents a case. Mm-hmm.
You know, we had an interesting friend last week. We did a few things. This was the Black family, the Taylors, that were with us last week. And Karen and Beatrice have become very, very dear friends. But it was interesting, in their dealing with their family, Beatrice came up with a good thought, which is hard. But, you know, if you just say a positive no, you know, and I know they come with, you know, five alternatives to the no. But sometimes you say, the alternatives are called just no. And I was surprised in a couple situations it worked pretty well. But each child is different. You know, again, yeah, someone mentioned, different. Everyone is different. Yeah. You have to manage it differently.
I had a child that no meant no and yes meant yes. Uh-huh. But I have one that... It didn't mean anything. Just didn't listen. Yeah, and I had raised my kids through these teenage years by myself. Uh-huh. But I always felt that what I did, they were watching. And if I had an answer for them, and the reason why, I got through these ages where dope was all around them.
Mm-hmm.
And they never touched it. And mm-hmm. they were able to go out and say no, and the reason why. One of my youngest mm-hmm. girls had a girlfriend that had dope on her all the time and begged her to use it. And she turned around there and told her, "You've got so much to offer and you're wasting your life." But that one girl came back and said, "It's because of her that I am in the place I am today." Mm-hmm. But see, I feel that you have to be at that place first.
Right.
The kids aren't going to be there.
I remember one time my oldest girl came to me and asked me if I would please talk to her friend because she was engaging in some behavior she thought wasn't good. And so I can't approach your friend unless she comes to me, but I do think it probably would be better if you talked to one of your teachers that also teaches your friend, so, because they already have a relationship right. there. She was so exasperated that what she said never didn't seem to carry any weight.
Oh. I know that in dealing with a, for instance, a drug issue, our son came as a younger, came along at a time when the drugs were much more prevalent. Mm-hmm. And so in dealing with him, and you cannot follow your children anyway. We know that. Once they reach that age, our responsibility, in a sense, is to teach them to leave you. In other words, that's our parental and Christian duty, is teach your children how to leave you. And that's hard too, because you don't really want them to go. I mean, you love them, you don't want them to go. But that's so for that reason, as you reach those teen years, you have to give the opportunity for increasing leaving and increasing responsibility. But I remember telling my son, knowing that there was no way that he could be in a circle of friends without drugs and alcohol being present. I tried to say, you know, as we were sitting around a circle, what I tried to say to him was, the true test of character for you will come when the pot is passed around, or the bottle is passed around, that you turn it down. Now that's hard. That's hard for a teenager, hard for a kid. And I believe there's some things that you may not want to know. And all you do is you give the you give the test, and then you say, thank God they don't end up in a real problem. And I think I tried to explain that to him more so than I think to the girls, although we did talk about that in a home, as they went out into the community. There were kind of three rules. If you go to a party at a place, the parents aren't home, turn around and leave. If there's alcohol, turn around and leave. If there's drugs, turn around and leave. That was the instruction at that stage. I think the instruction was slightly different for this. Go ahead.
I think, but as we were growing up, I mean, people thought, that being that my dad was the high school principal, thought that all our decisions were made by our parents, particularly our dad, and that which was not the case. And it comes back to something that you said back there. We knew what the consequence would be of our behavior, and that was laid out. And it wasn't any real clear line of a consequence. But I think as we were growing up, that thought of our parents losing their trust in us, the faith in us, somehow that was instilled, but it wasn't said outright, and we knew that. We also knew he was the principal of the high school, and that and so we knew growing up that we had a responsibility to our family to not take away from what he was doing within the school. And you know, how do you, and so I think the next question is, how do we bring about the sense of responsibility our children have to the family as they're growing up, so they feel like they're part of it, and that they do contribute a great responsibility to the family, not just in chores, but the family is a unity.
Well, I just love to have them have it in chores.
Well, we do that too. We do that too. But I mean, not they say not just in chores.
But well, we talk about today, you know.
That's the last thing that happens.
Yeah. It's hard today too, because our life is so good. You know, washers, dryers, riding mowers.
Yeah.
you can't employ kids. It's a, you know, it's a real difficult thing.
And then there's some kids that get paid for doing the chores, and other kids, like mine, don't.
Right.
Or they get allowance, or?
Yeah, they feel like they're discriminated against.
That was a good comment. Now, then was the extension. The one thing I do remember was really a joy to me during the time the girls were in the same school was the fact that my office door was always open as a principal. I always would like to have done like the old headmaster back in New England, for whom a book was written. Famous guy. He had his desk right out in the hall for 67 years. And but I tried to keep an open door, and so that the almost anyone could come in and out of the office. Well, when, of course, Karen and Kathy were at school, where they were able to come in and out of the office, and then all their friends came in and out of the office. We had more of that. And you might talk a little bit about our extended family during those years, which I think offered a very interesting way of dealing with other cultures and people.
I guess.
The extended family.
Okay. Not only was his office door open, the doors to our home were always open to other people. And we started out back in 1958, and we had a cousin from Denmark live with us. And his parents wanted to come over and have a year of school. So, you know, the world, to teach him how to study, because they figured they were going to send him with my grandfather, because they were originally going to live with Grandpa, because Grandpa was so strict. And they thought he had learned some good study habits and get down to business. Then we had, after that, we had a Japanese girl, Sachiko, live with us when I was in junior high. And she went to a vocational school to learn some secretarial skills and then went back to Japan. We had another girl that was a good friend of my sister's. One night, my sister was with a friend and driving down a common road, and this girl was out walking, crying. Her mother had kicked her out, had no place to go. So she lived with us for about a six-month period. I can't remember, but she was sleeping on the hide bed in the family room. And then at the same time, there was a boy whose father had died, and his mother was in the hospital just having diagnosed his cancer. To finish out the year, he lived in our home, too. And Lee and John were both there at the same time. That was the same year that I met B. Taylor, who was up here this last year, and she was living with a foster family and in the Tacoma area. And she needed, the foster family was going to California over vacation. She needed a place to stay. So, I mean, we invited her to stay with us. And we did not know at that time what a relationship would develop from that.
I think it was kind of cute about that incident, though. Karen was on the fashion board at one of the stores and was responsible for putting on a fashion show. Well, she was able to include B in this fashion show for Nordstrom. It was really kind of a thrill for her. I don't think she would have gone to California if she could, because to miss that would have been kind of tough, too.
Yeah, so but the doors were always open. And I think that a boy from France stayed with our parents for about a month period. And it wasn't so much that, you know, and then eventually the whole family came to our house. I didn't get to do a lot of traveling, but always the world was coming into us. And at some point, if we have the money to travel, we'll have places to stay. and get out there, but we just don't have the money to.
That is really true too, because I've done it both ways, and it really is true.
Does that enrich a family life, though?
Yes, it does. It really does.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we were talking a little bit about, the extended family. Just as you, the neighbor became the extended family.
Well, we've even got daughters and sons that aren't ours, and we still communicate through AFS to the neighbors.
Yes,
and our own daughters.
Wonderful program. Oh, is that?
And I think because of having them in our own home, that's why she chose to do that. And, you know, to go, it was a year ago in the summer, that month. And our younger daughter is already talking about an experience that she would like to have when she's in high school. So I think that extended family, and we started out just by having weekend AFS students to try it out, because, you know, you don't want to really jump in, or that was our feeling at the beginning was, you know, for a whole year, that's a long time to have somebody, you know. In fact,
and not inexpensive today.
No, not really. It's, but it's worth it.
Yes.
As far as we're concerned, in fact, we're talking about doing it again. Miami's in there.
So many people don't have large enough homes for that.
No. Yeah. Well, we don't have too large.
Well, there's always room though.
Mm-hmm.
We
always have room.
We also have the Marines that come and stay there. Our son's friends. We have in the summer. We put up our trailer, and they'll come and they take their furloughs with us, and they call us mom and dad too. Mm-hmm. The one called from California, and I said, "Who are you talking to?" She said, "Jeff," and then I talked to him. It's really.
You know, I get chills thinking about it. I think that's such a beautiful relationship. Mm-hmm. And then what it also does, it allows you to be a witness to your Christian faith. I mean, we had, you know, all religions, you know, different religions represented, and all those kids, maybe some with little or none. And the one, we wouldn't do it probably quite so much now, but this cousin from Denmark we had, he had to go to church with us every Sunday. That's one of the rules. She's like, here, you go to Vespers. And he would sometimes somewhat resist, but he always went. And then we had his daughter here a year or so ago stay with us, and it was a little different. It wasn't quite the same. She was 19 or 20 years old. But I think you can be a witness to your faith through that extended family contact. They know that you are witnessing and representing the
Even if they just do it for you.
And for you too, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Holden Village has always been our extended family.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
People who pass through our town who have been to Holden Village always know that they have a place to stay. And there was one time when a whole bunch of them came, so that we had them spread out all over the floors. But they knew that they had shelter.
Yeah. No, I think
Bring
that's...
Yeah.
Give us your address.
But I was going to say, we had a big house, then we could do that, but now we have a little dinky apartment and have just barely enough room for ourselves. Mm-hmm.
I think if we know when things are good, it's easy to bring people into our homes. But what happens when there's some kind of, there's an unresolved, irreconcilable difference within the family, neighborhood, or church? How do we work with communication in those, in that way? Or some people that we really have conflicts with, how do we
You have it in within your family, too.
If you have it within your family, right.
Because I had a daughter that would go to her father, never came to me for anything. And just before he passed away, we discussed it, and I said, well, be glad the door is open. Mm-hmm. I said, no matter who she goes to, she can go. Well, the Lord took him. Here I was with no communications mm-hmm. with her. But it took about 8 years, and now we're very close.
Mm-hmm. Our pastor told a story in one of his newsletters that I thought I'd just share, because I thought it was kind of a tragic story for his friend. He's about 13 years old, and he explained about a boy by the name of Bruce Kimber back in Wisconsin. And he was a very, very bright, intelligent boy. And I think if you look on the streets, look at the homeless, and deal with some of those kids on the street, you find some of them very bright, and you find very courageous. I never thought of myself being able to go on the streets of Seattle or Chicago.
Survivors.
They are not only survivors, but yeah, we have not touched them. But here is a boy that ended up in the home for children, Wittenberg, Wisconsin. They moved from Wisconsin. And this was back, of course, in some days. It was a bad place. It would not be my first choice for a home. He, however, was in the confirmation class with the pastor. But, and he said, it was kind of cute, he said this, in those days, about the only way to avoid confirmation was by joining the French Foreign Legion. That's probably about right. On the day of confirmation, all four of us, one day, of course, what happened was that one day his family just really said they didn't want him anymore. And so he was an orphan in a sense by default. He had no choice about it. He took the confirmation exam and everything was pretty bad for him. And of course, then the pastor Brocker answered the questions very well, and his mother told him what a wonderful job he'd done. And my mom said it was good his parents weren't there because they would have been embarrassed. That's true, but it really wouldn't make any difference. They didn't care about him anyway. You know, that's, I think, isn't that the tragedy today about so many of our kids, that no one really cares about them? And that's, so that's, how do you establish, well, I think our question here, or our point of discussion was, what has been done to keep them together? And then, of course, Brocker tells the story of the prodigal son. And I think that was one of our lessons one morning, was it not? Mm-hmm. I think that Elmer or someone mentioned that either in Matins or about the way, you know, the father raced out to welcome him, you know, and the tendency to say, you know, if you don't conform, don't expect any help from me. But anyway, there may be some, I thought it was a rather interesting story that related this kind of thing where communications break down so you can't even talk at all.
Well, it can happen. Mm-hmm. My oldest son is not living the way that I would choose for him to live. And it's kind of interesting that he still communicates with me even though I don't approve of his lifestyle. He calls and tells me a lot of things I don't even want to know.
Yeah.
But, you know, the doors are open for communication. But even the woman he's living with and he's not married to calls me two or three times a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have the communication there, and they know I don't approve of their lifestyle. So he knows exactly what's going on in my mind. And I feel like I'm very fortunate because we can talk, and they know I disapprove. And it must give them something to think about, you know?
Yeah. And of course, that is such a frequent occurrence today.
It is.
That's nothing. That's
but that happened with my husband's son. He was living with the girl, but though he didn't approve, he didn't approve, and yet they kept the communications open. And now, the son was away from the church for quite a while, but now they have a little boy who's been back in the church and become very active, and the communications are really improving, and it's just wonderful to see how he's
I like to hear that.
Yes, that's what I thought it might be.
They
help and encouragement. Yes, they did.
Well, I think that tells a story, too, about maybe the early training of children. Now that's a wonderful story of the prodigal. I mean, the prodigal son had a very good lessons from the father and all of the example and the inspiration, but he left. He said, let me take my inheritance, now go. And I think is also one of the most beautiful parables in the Bible, because it is it goes to show that when they return probably because they had some knowledge of the foundation. They don't forget that.
I think you do see that relived so often in our times, where with some of our children, we just have to let them go and try what they have to try. Keep those lines of communication open. Talk to them. They know you don't approve, and yet you don't close the door ever. And for some people, it just takes those few years to try a few things out, and then they're ready to
grow up.
Well, that's right. They have to grow up and mature. But oh, it's so hard through that time.
My youngest one went away to school, and we went up there, and of course I saw this. They had, she had a write-up in the paper, and at the end they said they had their beer parties, you know. And they said, she said, Mother, did you read that whole article? And I think she wanted me to comment on what I had read. I said, yeah, I read it all the way through. And she said, what do you think of the article? And I said, Well, what do you think I think about it? And she said, well, Mother, I do even worse than that. And I said to her, well, you know, I said, I've left you in God's hands. Your responsibility is to God, not to me anymore. And so she came home 2 weeks later. I think it bothered her. She came home 2 weeks later and she says, Mom, you know I don't do those things. But
she wanted a reaction.
She wanted my reaction right away. And I didn't react to it because I knew that sooner or later she'd come across, but she wanted to see if I was gonna react to it.
I think.
No, go ahead, Betty. No, we'd rather hear you.
Communication seems so important. And I wish that years ago we would have heard a little bit more about that, even in our church, so that we would have had the courage as children to have learned to communicate more with our parents, because my father was a very, very angry man. And now, years past, I understand perhaps a little more. But I didn't like to bring my friends home and things like that, because didn't know when he would be very angry about something, and I was always so embarrassed. And so I know that particularly myself and my sisters always kind of just left or didn't really want to go home with that kind of thing. And we didn't really resolve that, and I don't even know if we fully did until my father was perhaps about 75 years old, till we really started. He would even let us talk about it. You know, we would try and he would just cut us off until he was older and ill, that we began talking about it, and I think we all made peace. He died last year, but we made a peace. We could finally talk about how angry he was and how he had been that way always, and how we had felt so upset so often when he would be so angry wherever we would be, you know, that we would be so embarrassed.
Yeah.
And it has reminded me, that helped remind me over the years, that no matter how difficult it is or how much it hurts, or even sometimes to hear our children say things and so on, to talk about it as much as we can, as openly as we can.
Right.
I lament one thing, it seems to me, that our children who are older, we used to insist that everybody be there for the evening meal. And
yeah,
that's when
that
we really shared and tried to have the older ones give the little ones time to say their things too, but that we would talk about issues or talk about things that were happening and so on. I see now, even in my children's families, that that's almost impossible for
right.
them to get everybody at one meal, whatever the meal
it gets
might
more
be.
Difficult.
Yeah,
we had that problem when we came on this trip this year to get the two
mm-hmm.
older ones to have our little family council thing so we could discuss things that we kind of wanted done.
How old are
what
they?
We expected. Well, they're 19 and 20.
Yeah, that's.
And they were here with us 5 years ago, but mm-hmm. because of, you know, going to school and that they, you know, college, they really needed for their, you know, the work, which we felt bad about. We finally decided the only way we could do it is if we went out to a restaurant, and that's what we did. We went out for dinner. They couldn't get out of the
that's
either.
Right.
We invited
yeah.
them, so we could all do that.
That always works when you invite them to dinner, I tell you. You're the whole gang.
That's interesting about the importance of you eating together,
mm-hmm.
at least one meal. I know we kept a teenager with us. She was a daughter of a friend of ours who was having marital problems. And I said, well, if it would make it any easier, let Bonnie come and stay with us for a semester. They lived in Oklahoma. We lived in Rock Island, Illinois.
That's a long way.
She said, do you really mean that? And I said, yes, we like Bonnie, and I think it would be a good thing. And we have plenty of room. So Bonnie stayed with us. And then her brother came to visit her. And she says, and you know, we eat our meals together. We all sit down and eat our meals together. That was the big thing for her. Because
yeah,
she'd never experienced that before.
Well, a lot of kids just eat and run or eat at the nearest door.
Yeah.
I experienced that in my teaching. Kids come with no food. Or when I first started teaching, we had a program where they'd go home for lunch. 50% of the kids ended up at the little store with a bottle of pop and a bag of potato chips or something. They never went home for any meal.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, there are lots of kids like that growing up. I mean, those are a lot of the kids that have a lot of problems.
Yeah, I think, you know, the mealtime is an important time of just sharing. And I, as a parent, we really try and sit down for dinner together. Mornings. My daughters were in piano lessons 2 mornings a week, which made it difficult. But 3 mornings, we sat down before school and had a hot breakfast together. And we did. It was a time we did some devotions together. And my husband has to leave for work at 6 a.m, so he didn't get to be part of that. But just by having a little bit of a devotion that in the morning, it led the kids into certain discussions as far as things that they could do during that day and time to bring up concerns. And it was a good way to start the day out in a positive way. And they did like that. But I think, you know, dinner time to talk through a lot of those issues at night to have a kind of a place to really become grounded in, it is important. There was one other thing I wanted to say about. Oh, church. Where does the church play a role in your family? We had, I know, as we were growing up, we went to church every Sunday. There was no question about it. We got up and went, and you know, and I'm still used to that, and I take our kids, go to church, practice just about every Sunday. There's very few Sundays that they do miss, but they see all their friends, and then they see a lot of their friends in the neighborhood. Some cousins do not go to church, and they think, well, I'd rather be out playing. I'd rather go skiing. I'd rather, you know, this. And when we basically said, and this is where I think the Bible does help, having laws above myself, laws that God has set out, that's not just my law, that we need to, you know, honor God on Sundays. And so it's a pattern that we've developed with our children, is to get them there. And we said we made that promise when you were baptized to take you to church. And it's, what have anybody else have you done here? Your kids
told our children, because by the time they reach early elementary, they're already noticing that their family isn't always like some of their friends' families. And we don't ever want to put down another person's lifestyle, but on the other hand, we've just always told them that their family has to do it their way and our family has to do it our way, and they're all going to be different, but this is the way that we do it in our family. This is important to us. And they seem to respect that so far. Even our 16-year-old, who does notice a lot of differences as far as curfews and things like that. But I suppose because he has always heard that, not that he doesn't test it, but he does know that there are certain things that we are just going to be doing differently from other families.
I think what you said about the baptism, that it's really kind of the responsibility of parents to educate their children in the church, or to get them there and have the Sunday school orderly. I think our feeling was that once they got confirmed, then it was really up to them, because they were members themselves, and they have been pretty good about going to church. Our 2 older ones, sometimes they sleep in because they've, you know, been out real late or something, but they have to make that choice at that time. But I think as a parent, a younger child, that you have to guide them and get them there.
There are many things that my 15-year-old disagrees with me about, and we are in conflict a lot. But I think because church has always been a priority, we have gone every Sunday, he, so far, has not said he wouldn't go. The other thing that I think is a real plus is our church makes a real effort to have the kids actively involved. There's 168 kids that are in the senior high choir. So they go from 8, they have to be there from 8 until 10:30 every Sunday morning. And then he also has volunteered in Sunday school, and he really has enjoyed that. He gets a lot of positive reinforcement from helping collect the Sunday school offerings and marking attendance and stuff. I think he feels part of it, and I think that's a credit to the congregation.
Uh-huh.
That's a real important thing. We have 2 new ministers at our church, and one of the things is the youth involvement in our confirmation program and in helping with Sunday school, act lighting. They're forced to, but it's kind of required that they do sign up for volunteers at events like that. And then we have what's called the WIP dinner. And we start out once a month, and now we're doing it twice a month. Once where we have volunteer parents come and cook the meal, and the other time they just bring a bag lunch. And then we have a program that's involved with that. And the kids, I'm involved in the confirmation program, so I take part in the dinners and that too. The kids just love to come. In my class last year, I think one student only missed one dinner the whole time. And I kind of asked the kids, well, you know, how come you come to these? And why? They said, it's just the fellowship and getting to know the other kids in the church.
Where are you located?
It is important.
Well, in Minnesota, why is that?
Oh, in Minnesota, why is that? Yeah, I was just trying to think of it. That's
we're a quite large congregation and growing. I think that really makes a difference too. I grew up in a small congregation where there, you know, I think there were like six of us confirmed, and it really, to me, we had a close group. But I can see my own children involved in more activities than I was ever involved in. I thought I was pretty active in the church.
I think if you have activities in the church for young people, I think that's why we went to the church we went to, is because we were youth leaders and we wanted our children active in church to keep them there. And they even, there's no problem going to church because they want to be in part of it.
That's it. If they develop friends there, they want to be with their friends. So I think we should make lots of opportunities outside of church to have social things, little parties in our home, so they get to know those children other than just as a classmate.
Yeah. But do many people find that there's some different activities that young people have now? There's the different sports and the different music things and other activities that they're in that they just don't seem to have time for the church activities or kind of school. And,
That's for sure.
There's a conflict,
hard,
I'm sure.
It's really hard. Another thing that's hard is, get back to community again, but my children are in a city school, and the churches that we belong to have all been in the city, but they're not like their school population by any means. It's pretty limited to white middle class, Northern European, you know, people, and in school through over the years, they have formed very close friendships with other people, and they've got commitments in different places, and that pulls them away. You know, that creates isn't that even an ideological conflict so much as just a time problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they just, how many close friends and social-wising things can you incorporate? And now I'm in a situation where, I mean, I'm thinking, oh, I should really, they need more friends that are like them. I mean,
I think you're, what's important. Yeah, go ahead.
There's no social draw in their teenage years toward the church,
right,
because their social life is with people that aren't in the Lutheran church.
The church I go to, I switched churches when my oldest was entering teenagehood because of the number of activities they have for teenagers. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I was so impressed with this congregation is because it's not closed. I've been born and raised Missouri Synod. I have no idea how those churches are over and above board. But it seemed like all the activities were for church members. And when I switched to this LCA congregation, 50% of the 50% of the people who participate in anything church offers are not members of that church. And I really like that. We have a pastor and youth leader who actively go out and eat lunch in the high schools that surround
that
church. Well, that's
fabulous.
And invite the kids in so that, the kids are encouraged to go. There are quite a few kids that join that church in high school of their own volition. You know, the parents don't belong. And that's what made
well, that's why they join, though, too, is because they've been invited.
That's right.
And that's how our program is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the thing, and I read it in
pretty critical.
You can bring a friend, but you got to sign up because maybe only 50 spots, you know, for some of the activities. So, I mean, it fills up. because of that, and like I say, same as our congregation, we have at least 30% of the kids aren't from our church, but that's where you get your new members.
That's where you're reaching.
Now, they're all from not Lutheran, and there isn't a big push to have them join either.
No.
I think that's critical in the new church too, this very discussion. I hope those stories are put into the publication that the new church has. The other thing I think it's quite critical as you relate that kind of solution and communication to problems among teenagers is the fact that the public school has been somewhat limited in what it can do in terms of the teaching of Christian moral and spiritual values. Now, and it may very well be, I did some sessions last week on the Supreme Court decisions and so forth, but the public school has been limited in what it can do in terms of moral and spiritual teaching and training. Therefore, I think it's critical that the church comes out with programs like you're describing to fill what I think is a gap. And that sounds exciting to me.
To use the word critical also, though, it would go all the way back from their first breath or now, even before they're born, that parents also make a real commitment to our life in Christ. Mm-hmm. That's what the children see from the beginning. And that it not only be go to Sunday school, and sometimes I see parents taking the kids to Sunday school and they go back home. It's what we say throughout the week and every day with our lives, what the children are going to see. So that even sometimes when they don't stay in the church during their teenage years, perhaps the foundation has been laid there beyond just saying, church is important. It has to, like so many things, it has to come. First of all, like Pastor Perel told us so often, Jesus Christ himself is why I'm doing this. This is why I go to church. This is why we want to be a family that worships together also.
As that old Mosaic law says, give me a child from the ages 3 to 9 and remain in the faith or a return to it. And of course that's what happened to Moses in terms of giving the right instruction early in his life.
I think quite often too that going to church on Sunday morning, you go to foreign countries and you find that the state is involved and it's a different situation. But we don't go to church because it's a duty necessarily. We go because we love it and love our Savior. And that makes the difference.
Yes. There, you know, you talk about some of these lost children. There's a, in the Hope newsletter, October 1985, it's a from the Bob Hope Institute. It says, young lawbreakers advise parents. Is that the Reverend C. Galea asked boys at the Gulf Correction Center for clues as to why they ended up in that institution, and then asked them to draw up a code for parents. Here it is. Well, they went through a series to keep cool, don't get strung out from too much booze or too many pills. Bug us a little, be strict. Don't blow your class, stay on that pedestal. And it says, light a candle, show us the way. Tell us God is not dead or sleeping or on vacation. We need to believe in something bigger and stronger than ourselves. You know, scare us if you catch us lying, stealing, or being cute, and get tough. When we need punishment, dish it out. Call our bluff. Make it clear you mean what you say. Be honest. Tell us the truth no matter what. And praise us when we deserve it. If you give us kids a few compliments once in a while, we'll be able to accept criticism a lot easier. There's more in this article if you care to read it. I'll leave it here. But I think it, you know, but the thing that really struck out is to light a candle, show us the way, and tell us God is not dead or sleeping or on vacation.
And you know what that says? That says we have to continually be parents, not just good buddies and friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very good point.
Sometimes you can't be like a good buddy when it comes to you have to be firm. You remain parents.
I think that's what they would always, you know, Dad always said, I will always be your father, not your, and I won't necessarily be a friend, but he was always there to listen, but he was always that parent. And kind of that, you know.
I think that's a good comment for teachers and principals too. I mean, there is a responsibility that you have to lead as a parent, mother or father. And we recognize now too that there are more single parent homes, and we have to recognize that also is a family in the same sense, and the same responsibilities exist to nurture in that family as well. And I think that's quite important.
That's a whole other almost session.
It's another topic, Maureen, but I mean it is, I think it'd make a very interesting topic, just maybe really? Deal with the single parent or the issues, because that's a big job.
It's a real difficult thing.
Well, it's a hard thing when you're thrown into that and you're the only one.
Well, there's an awful lot of single parents too.
Yes.
And because of it, a lot of kids have trouble relating to either male or female, depending who they live with. Yeah. And I see that when I teach little kids third graders, and I can see a lot of them when they come in, like, well, not a lot, but every year it seems to get one or two, they'll start to cry because I'm the first male that really had contact with in the school system. Maybe they've been with the principal or something, but I mean, and it's kind of scary to them. And it seems every year there's one or two that mom will bring them, they'll start to cry, and as soon as mom's gone, they know that I'm not going to. But they've probably been mistreated or abused by males already.
Yeah. That's right, they're afraid.
That's it. It's great to have some male teachers, good caring male teachers, especially the elementary.
Really, and where Chuck works, I've been in the school and I've worked with him. I mean, those kids really need him. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful that he's there.
That's the other thing too, I think that parents need to understand. There are times in life when a child has a more difficult time talking to mother or dad. What I think is terribly important is that when you talk about the extended family, Karen suggested that too, but that they know they have a teacher or a pastor or a counselor that they can turn to. And then parents have to be very careful they're not jealous of that. And I think that can happen. Your son goes to see a friend because he has a problem, and you say, gee, why did he come to me? That's why you want to have those other important people to answer those kinds of
questions. When we were in youth work, we had the pastor's son come to us, and confidentially.
Yeah.
My husband said to the first thing, of course, you know what you think, we should go and talk to the parent. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, he came confidentially. He'll come back to you. And he did. And he was having a problem with his parents, actually.
We're going to conclude the session. I enjoy the little brochures I get from the Christophers, which is a Father Coutois Catholic organization. I just read this little as a conclusion to our session. And 10 ways to raise self-centered children. 1, from infancy, give them everything they want. This way they will grow up to believe that the world owes them a living. 2, never give them any spiritual training. Wait until they are 21. And let them decide for themselves. 3, avoid corrections and never punish them. They may develop a guilt complex. 4, pick up everything they leave lying around. They will learn to lay their responsibilities on the shoulders of others. Boy, sometimes in my room it's something. 5, let them watch or read whatever they want so they can become their own teachers in matters pertaining to sexuality. 6, quarrel frequently in their presence so they can become acquainted to arguments as a way of life. 7, give them all the spending money they want. Why should they not? Why should they have things as tough as you had them? 8, try to satisfy every whim when it comes to food, drink, and comfort. Self-denial might lead to harmful frustrations. Take their part against neighbors, teachers, or policemen. This will help them to understand that everyone is prejudiced against them. 10, when they get in real trouble, blame the system. They should never fear remorse over anything. One sure way to raise loving children is this: teach them to follow the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.